Accession number 18535, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Maurice Maine, recorded in Gloucestershire on July the 14th, 1998, by Rodney Giesler for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Right, first of all, can you tell me when you were born?
Yes, 26th of December, 1920.
And what was your family background? What did your father do?
My father was a draper in the outfitting trade, as indeed was most of the family.
And whereabouts was this?
That was in New Cross. I was born in New Cross, South East London.
And how did you come to join the RAF?
How did I come to join the RAF? Well, I was working for my father in 1940, but the excitement of war became too great for me, so I sneaked off one afternoon and joined up at joined the RAF at a pub in Eltham, the Yorkshire Grey.
At a pub?
At a pub. It was, yes, turned into a recruiting centre. A very, very big pub, to which I went many years later for functions. But it was a pub, and all sorts of chaps were there, and I was duly examined and thought that I would then be posted quickly to a unit and be flying in 10 minutes. But unfortunately, it wasn't quite that. I was sent home, and then later on, I was sent a telegram to report to Uxbridge, where I was properly attested at Uxbridge and given my number. But once again, I was sent home, and I wasn't called to the services until about September 1940, when I went to Blackpool, did my initial square bashing and the initial wireless training, and having passed out from there, we were sent down to Yatesbury, a famous place for wireless operators. Spent my time in Yatesbury, passed out from there, and then I went from Yatesbury as a temporary post into Catterick, where they were urgently in need, apparently, of wireless operators, and I was put in a caravan out in the field in order to operate ZZ landings, of which I'd had no training, didn't know anything about. I always remember a certain squadron leader, Finley, was up there, who didn't strike me like the disciplined RAF officers that I would expect. He had a casual scarf, his clothes were very casual, but apparently he was an excellent pilot. I think it was a fighter drone. And I had to stay in this field for a fortnight in this caravan, with sheep, having lambs nearby, dreadful noises in the night. And when they were going to operate, they would phone me up from HQ and tell me what direction to turn the wheel.
What was this ZZ landing? How did it work?
I don't quite. I'm just reading about it in the book there I've got, but I'm not quite certain how it worked. It was a sort of a direction finding system. The HQ would phone me up and tell me what bearing to take on the aerial, and I suppose then the pilot coming into land would pick up that bearing. I'm not really certain.
You sent out a signal.
Yes.
And the pilot homed on it.
That's right. That's more or less what it was.
If he was too far to the right, it said a lot of dots, and too far to the left, a lot of
dots. Dits and dots.
That was the principle.
Yes,
of it.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I see.
That
yeah.
was the rough yeah. idea of ZZ yeah. Landing. From there, I was suddenly posted to, from Catterick, I went down to, Stormy Down, that was the air gunnery school. Passed out from there, and then down to Chivna for an OTU, where eventually I teamed up with other chaps. It was very casual in those days, and I suppose it always was later on, but very casual, the crewing up. You just saw chaps you liked, and their face seemed to fit.
You were a WAP AG, were you?
I was a WAP AG.
Yeah.
Yeah. So eventually I was part of a Beaufort crew, posted to Thorney Island. From there, the squadron was moved to St. Evil, and back from St. Evil to Thorney Island again. And then
what were you flying?
Beauforts, torpedo bombs. Yeah. My first pilot, a charming chap, Tommy Lee, but after one trip, we attacked the one of the German destroyers or cruisers, the Neisenau, and the shells were so close though it both of us fly very low over the sea, as you may have, very, very low ceiling, in order to give impetus to the torpedo. And as we were making the attack, huge splashes were coming up, almost hitting the aircraft. And having let our torpedo go, we turned around, and then I got a view of the... I was in the turret then. I got a view of the ship. I could see the shells coming over. And we got back quite safely.
Where was the Gneisenau in harbour? Was it in harbour or at sea?
That was on the day they were making their dash through the channel. Yes. The Gneisenau, the Eugen, and the Eugen, yeah.
And they were going up from San Jose?
Yes.
Up the channel?
Up the channel. They're trying to...
You intercepted them just off the Brittany coast, did you?
Yes, yes,
out
it was. No, I'm sorry. That day we had to fly up to Manston to pick up a fire to escort, which we lost. It was a chaotic day. Something went wrong with... It was a chaotic day, I really must say that. We were supposed to pick up a fighter escort at Manston. But when we arrived there, someone came running out onto the air, onto the field and told us to go straight, gave us rough directions, and we went out there. Saw the Gneisenau and made our attack. Thought we'd hit it. It was a great big orange flash and one thing and another, but it wasn't registered as a hit. But sadly enough, the very next day, the pilot, a Sergeant Tommy Lee, very nice chap, wasn't about. And he'd given up. He was made LMF, you know. He never appeared anymore.
Was that a fairly horrendous attack you were on? I mean, was that the last straw for him?
I think it must have been.
Yeah.
I think it must have been.
What other ops had you flown in Beauforts up to that time?
Not very many. A bit of mine laying. Mostly square searches of the Atlantic, looking for subs, anti-sub patrols in the main. We always used to have to look out. When we're doing anti-sub patrols, which always fascinated me, we're always told to look out for tunny fishermen. Irish tunny fishermen, which always mystified me, because at that stage I always used to think the Irish was a fairly friendly crowd. And on one occasion we saw one, and it was like a huge rowing boat, like a really big rowing boat, no superstructure at all, just a great big boat with men sitting all the way around with their flat caps. They all looked typically Irish, and all we had to do is note their position. We wasn't in no way should we attack or fly too low or anything like that. But I think they were suspected of sort of liaising with the German subs.
Yeah.
But any proof of that, I don't know. But square searches, we did quite a few from St. Evel, and they were rather boring, you know. We did a raid on Nantes one night. We also did a leaflet raid on Nantes, which... I made a little bit of a mess. I was the one to drop the leaflets down the chute. They put in a little chute in the middle of the aircraft. It was my job to put the leaflets down. Now, they were tied up in bundles, like ballot size, about 8 inches square almost, and just big enough to go down the chute. But being in the textile trade and used to using lots of cotton string and able to break it, I was staggered at the poor quality of the string. I couldn't believe it. It was very, very cheap stuff, and I thought, well, that'd break too easily. So when the signal was given me to start putting down the string, I took the first bundle, broke the string quite easily, surprised how easy it broke, and started putting them down the chute. But to my horror, they all blew back. In a second, they were everywhere. They were behind the pilot's ears. They were on the windscreen. They were down tucked between the one. I realised then that one should just drop the whole bundle down, and the impetus as they went through the air would break them and spread the leaflets. That was a foolish mistake I made. And if you want another funny story, I might tell you that on one occasion we were flying, and you know what young men are, one said, terrible smell went through the aircraft, terrible smell. And there was accusations flying around from pilot to gunner to wireless operator. So I was told to have a look at the loo. Now, just we had an open hatch at the side of the Beaufort on which we used to put an extra gun, an extra Vickers gun. And just under that was a little loo. It was a sort of black bucket inside, which would usually be emptied. Unfortunately, the poor ground staff, when the plane had been used last time by another crew, they hadn't emptied this bucket. So I looked at it, it was a horrible sight, so I thought, well, I'll tip it out. So I got the bucket and went to tip it out. Now, everybody thinks I'm going to say that it will come back over me, but that wasn't the case. The slipstream, which I didn't realise, was so strong that it was whipped out of my hand. And in a second, that bucket, black bucket, about 12 to 15 inches high, became a mere thimble as it went through the air. And when I looked down below, I couldn't believe my eyes. There were all beautiful green fields below. And what had happened, the navigator had decided to make a shortcut to the Atlantic. We had gone over Southern Ireland. So that's where the bucket landed.
Tell me a bit about, you know, when you were at torpedo bombing. I mean, that was quite a specialist bit of flying, wasn't it?
Yes, it did.
I mean, you had to be in an exact height above the sea.
Yes, we did. Yes.
To get the torpedo striking at the right angle.
Right angle and yeah. Right speed for right impetus. Very low. I think we should be about 60 to 100 feet off the deck. To me, I was often on the turret and on the guns, and it looked exceptionally low to me. And I always got the feeling that we were going at that angle, so we might go in, but we were very low.
And how was it started? Did its engine start before it was released, or on hitting the water, or what?
I think the navigator fired it. Probably set a switch.
And did you have to practice a lot?
Yeah, we didn't do a lot of practice once we were on the squadron, but we went on a special course at Abbotsinch, up in the, just off the Western Isles, and we used to practice up there. Torpedo. We also went on another experiment up there too, trying to drop a torpedo from a greater height with wings on it. And that never came to anything. I can't remember what plane was, but we'd carry this torpedo with sort of wings on it, and the idea was it would float down and then go in. But I don't think it was ever taken up. I think it's just one of these wartime experiments.
Anyhow, the day of the attack on the Gneisenau.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit more about that in detail? I mean, you had an awful lot of fire thrown at you, did you?
Oh, yes, there was a lot of fire thrown at us.
Because was that the same morning as the swordfishes went in, and they all got lost?
Yes. That was the same...
Esmond got a VC on it, didn't
That's he? Right, that yes. was the same day.
Yeah.
Yes. I can't really tell you much, because we'd been on standby at St. Evel for a considerable time. I remember... A couple of Canadian squadrons come down there to join in the affray. I think they were flying Wellingtons. And we was on standby for a considerable time, and quite suddenly we were told to take off to fly to Manston. And we went to Manston, and we barely landed when we were told to give them different directions. It was supposed to be all well arranged, because it's quite essential to have, on such an attack, to have fighter support. Because you imagine you're flying very low, you're such an easy target for any fighters that might be in the area. But there was no fighter escort. They'd gone out and earlier on. It was confusion that day. I'm sorry to say it. It was really confusion. And we got out there, and quite suddenly we saw this little tiny grey ship. And as we got near, we thought at first it was the Eugen, but later on we knew it was a Gneisenau.
And that was over in the Pas-de-Calais area, wasn't it?
Yes.
They were nearer the French coast.
They were, yes, yeah. Yes, mm. Yes, we were a fair way.
So once you released your torpedo, of course, you just legged it home, I suppose.
We headed off as fast as we could, yes, yeah.
What other operations did you go on after that?
Well, the operations, the only really interesting operation I went on was on the one I was shot down, because I don't know if you would know about it, but in 1942, some British ships that were holed up in Norway, they'd been secretly manned by British and Norwegian crews, and they were going to run the gauntlet and come down to Scotland.
These are merchant ships?
Yes, yeah. Yes. But they'd started off, and they were being harassed by German destroyers and other German battleships. So it was our job to find the German destroyers and attack them, which was quite an interesting thing. We were given escape money as well, you know, in case we had to land in Sweden, in case it was fair distance for the Beauforts to do.
You flew from where?
We flew, on that occasion, we flew from Lucas. And we got right to the Norwegian coast, and we started our square search. Very low cloud that day, very low cloud indeed. And we started our square search, and we'd got well into the Kattegat, I think it was. And quite suddenly we come across a German convoy. Not huge ships, I wouldn't say, not big ships, but we come across a German convoy. Now, at that time, I was flying with our CO, the wing commander. He picked myself and another gunner and a navigator as his crew. He was new to the area, new to the squadron. Paddy Ball. He'd already done one tour of operations. And anyway, we started our square search, come across this convoy. And quite sadly, and the convoy, I just remember vaguely, two long lines of ships, and Paddy Ball flew right down in the middle of them. Now, it wasn't our target. We were looking for destroyer, and we had been told, that's what we've got to do. Don't waste time on small coastal shipping, the destroyers we were looking for. But instead of that, he flew right down between them and started, like, banking from side to side. And then I heard him say, quite clearly, look, the idiots, they're firing at each other. Well, they weren't. They were firing at us. And we were hit. You know, and of course we went down, and sadly to say, Paddy Ball lost his life. But I think, you know, I should say this all these years after, but it was a bit of an act of recklessness.
So how many of you got out?
Two of us got out and two went down. The other gunner, Stan Clark, went down. And he was on the radio that day, and the navigator, John Sinclair, he managed to get out. The aircraft went straight in, just suddenly a bang, and when I came to, the turret had gone, the turret completely gone. The plug, you know, we had like a single brass plug for our earphones. My plug was at absolutely right angles, thick solid plug. But I suddenly found myself just in a circle, a metal circle. I stepped out of it into the water, and there about 10 feet away from me was our pigeon, because we used to carry a pigeon in those days in a yellow cage. I desperately tried to get it, but I felt so sorry for that poor pigeon. Gradually, it sank. It didn't take long to sink, and it was gone. And as I looked around, I suddenly saw Johnny Sinclair already in the dinghy. The dinghy had inflated automatically. And he was about 30 to 40 yards away from me, already in the dinghy. So I remember him shout out, swim for it, or something. And behind me was Stan Clark. And he was in the water, but a funny look on his face. And I said, and a very strong swimmer he was. And I said, swim for it, Stan. But within a few minutes,
Stan Clark.
He was behind me, funny look on his face. I only took about 3 strokes swimming, and I looked around and he was gone. He just disappeared completely.
Did you have Mae West on? Buoyancy aids?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Yes, we had our Mae West on. My harness was still on. My and my helmet with a training plug. I don't know, I swam very strong that day. And the Germans who picked me up later on said to me, which one shouted? I said, it was me. Because, you know, when you're in the water, your voice, when it's level with the water, carries very well indeed.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that I'd been shot down. I couldn't believe it. And I shouted out the most ridiculous thing. I shouted out, "We're British, you bastards." I mean, whatever prompted me to say it like that, I don't know. We're British. But anyway. Johnny Sinclair was in the dinghy. I eventually reached the dinghy, but it was already beginning to leak, and it was soft, and I was staggered. How big a dinghy is when you get to it, it's quite high up the sides, and I couldn't quite get in, so Johnny Sinclair reached over and got hold of the parachute harness, the straps over the top, which were only just caught on by a little piece of cotton, you might say, thin string, and they come apart, and as he pulled me across by a ridiculous piece of luck, it caught on. Oh, will you take it, Cyril?
Anyhow, you're pulled into the dinghy.
Pulled into the dinghy, stretched out like this, right across with the water in the bottom. Eventually the flagship came along by the side of us, hooked Johnny Sinclair out. But with me, they had to hook the whole darn thing. It folded round me like an orange, and they pulled and then cut it free and threw it away in the water. And carried me along. I had a cut on the front of the head, nothing terrible. But I must say they treated me very humanely. They were extremely nice blokes, which I didn't expect. They took us both down into the engine room where we shivered for about an hour with shock. I had my escape money on me, about £30 of escape money, which while shivering, they are helping me keep warm, put a blanket round. The money fell onto the floor, and they very kindly picked it up and gave it back to me.
It was Swedish money, was it?
Yes, it was Swedish money, yes, Swedish krona. And eventually we was taken to Kristiansund, and there on the quayside was the German staff car waiting for us with a duty officer on board and a driver. Staggered to see then that the guards around had their feet in giant baskets. They were stained like baskets shaped like big boots. Oh, really big. I suppose because it was so frosty and so cold. I don't know.
Was there snow on the ground?
Oh, yes, there was, yes.
When was this? What's the date of this?
1st of April, 42.
42, yeah.
And the staff, the car drove off with the officer in charge. He never said much to us. We drove to a block of flats. He went up in... Then he told me, incidentally, my friend, the navigator, had a very bad leg. He could hardly put his foot to the ground. So wherever we went, I had to carry him. So we got this block of flats, and I was told to pick up this chap, carry him on my back, and go upstairs to the flat. The officer knocked on the door, and a door opened. Oh, and it looked beautiful. Lovely lights, warm, cosy, and a very nicely appointed flat. And a big blonde lady came to the door with plaits, just like you'd see pictures of Norwegian people. Anyway, she came to the door, and he made the excuse that he couldn't see her that night because these blasted fleekers, the damned airmen, had got themselves done. He was duty officer. So he was responsible for us. And that was most peculiar.
And that was his girlfriend, I suppose.
That was his girlfriend, yes.
Were you under armed guard?
Only the guard, yes, one guard with the officer, that's all. And then from then on they took us to an army camp where we stayed overnight in a little, tiny little room with two soldiers sitting in with us. Once again, very pleasant chap. I always remember the soldier saying to me something like, you know, war not good. Hitler not good, Churchill not good, we're good though, we're good. Anyway, but that was... Eventually he was taken into Oslo.
Were you interrogated at all?
Not then. Not then we weren't interrogated. Taken to Oslo, where we were putting like a hotel, but the rooms had been turned into small cells. There was a little spire hole at the door where they could look through at you. But a very comfortable room, nice, very nice clean linen, and that was all right. And one day, it must have been near Easter time, the local Luftwaffe had heard that there was two RAF prisoners of war there, and got permission to take us out to their mess. And we went out to their mess. I always remember, beautiful day, snow all over the place, children in coloured clothing, pretty houses, different colours. And there was this German officer's mess, and we were taken there, and we typical Germans, all taller than us, tall, fair haired, blue eyes, beautifully turned out in their uniforms. And they kept on asking us what we thought of Hitler. There was a picture of Hitler on the wall, and they said, look at his eyes, don't they fascinate us? And we were saying, and I in particular was saying, have you not seen Churchill's eyes? They do the same for us, you know, it's the same effect on us. But up to then, being a prison war seemed quite all right.
Now, you were still wearing your uniforms, presumably?
Yes.
You were what, sergeants?
I was a sergeant then, yeah.
And you presumably had change of underclothes and stuff like that. You had your clothes washed clean, did you? Or was it just
the same clothes
you've been fished out of the sea?
No such luxuries as that. No, I can't remember. But we only just were able to wash. I can't remember having a bath or anything like that. Not at that stage. But later on, we were flown down from Oslo in a Junkers 52 down to Copenhagen, and then from Copenhagen on to Frankfurt on Main to Duleg Luft, which was the interrogation camp. And there we had proper showers. I was given a Yugoslav uniform while they took my uniform away and obviously examined it for special secret things like a map and the buttons we used to be issued with, the compass buttons. And Ezra is interrogated there, separated from each other. And Johnny Sinclair went on to the main camp in Ober-Silesia after about 4 or 5 days, but I was kept there for about 3 weeks.
What did they ask you?
All sorts of questions. First of all, they asked me simple questions. First, what school I went to, and what my father did, and where we'd lived, and why did I join the services, why did I join the RAF, why did I want to fly against Germany? Offering me players' cigarettes at the time, and asking me. The questions had nothing to do with it. Well, for instance, he said, "Oh, we had a Scottish pilot, and we couldn't. He wouldn't talk. He was very tour, and I couldn't understand what he meant by tour." He said, "You know the word tour? Never heard of it. Not in the way you're using it." No, he said he was tour. What he meant was dower, but their pronunciation going to. But there'd be simple questions like that. Then suddenly they said, of course, your pilot, he was a commanding officer, wasn't he? You know, I said, well, I only knew him as, I didn't know if he was a commanding officer or not, because I'd only recently just gone to fly with him. And I said, silly things like that. I mean, we were told all we had to give was our name and number. So it's very difficult not to answer their so-called simple questions, you know, but I sort of kept at it as long as I could. There were no threats or anything like that, nothing unpleasant, quite pleasant. But they had me there about 3 weeks, they showed me a picture of the aircraft. Was that the Beaufort you were flying in? Was it a Mark 1 or a Mark 2? I said, I wouldn't know, because I'm just a gunner, I'm just a simple, I wouldn't know, I'd just get in the aircraft. Anyway, well, that eventually, given back my uniform, and we went down to Ober-Silesia, a long train ride across Germany, with plenty of guards. And
what train was it? A sort of
stairs? Like a passenger train, a slow train.
So it was comfortable enough.
Yes, it wasn't.
It wasn't cattle wagon.
No, it wasn't cattle wagon. It was. Would you like some more coffee?
Yeah, I'm fine at the moment. Do you want a quarter, man? Anyhow, your journey down to where did you took camp?
In Lambsdorff. Near Oppeln, it's actually in the Polish area now.
Oh, Silesian area, wasn't it?
Yes. Lambsdorff, Stalag 8B. Got down there, most miserable sight I'd ever seen. There was lots and lots of Dunkirk veterans down there. You know, cold, it was cold and miserable. When we'd left the west, it had been quite warm, but it was cold down there and grim. And there were army chaps there with their collars turned up and their caps pulled down over their ears. wasn't exactly an inviting situation.